Let's turn to Ambassador Ido Aharoni. I met Ambassador Ido Aharoni when I hosted him to ask him to give a breakdown to our Olim Chadashim, our new immigrants in Israel who were concerned. And that was toward the beginning of the war. I thought he was so excellent that I've asked him to join us here tonight. Ambassador, will you stand up while I make your introduction, your official introduction? No, come over. Ambassador Ido Aharoni has served in too many important roles to name them all. Ambassador Aharoni is a 25-year veteran of Israel's Foreign Service, a public diplomacy specialist, and a founder of the Brand Israel program. Ambassador Aharoni is the longest-serving consul general in New York and the tri-state area from Israel to date. He stayed in the role for 6 years, overseeing the operations of Israel's largest diplomatic mission worldwide, and I'm so proud of that because I'm a New Yorker. A senior counselor and member of APCO's International Advisory Council, he served as a distinguished professor at New York University's School of International Relations in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. In September of 2007, Aharoni was appointed to serve as the nation's first head of brand management in Jerusalem, designed to improve Israel's positioning in the world by highlighting its relative advantages and increasing its relevance. In the spring of 2006, he was appointed to serve as a senior advisor and press secretary to Israel's foreign minister and vice prime minister, Zippy Livni. In that capacity, he introduced national branding methods and country positioning strategies as pillars of Israel's public diplomacy. Between 2001 and 2005, Ambassador Aharoni served as Israel's consul for media and public affairs at Israel's consulate general in New York and the tri-state area. He assumed this position just several weeks before the terror attacks of 9/11. I, as a New Yorker, am always very touched when I think of that day, as I was in grade school at the time, when I understood something terrible had happened to my city. And as the head of the department, Aharoni oversaw the operation of Israel's largest public diplomacy and media relations apparatus worldwide. From 1994 to 1998, Aharoni served as Israel's consul for communications and public affairs in Los Angeles and the southwestern United States. In that position, he covered the 7 southwestern states and in the United States and worked extensively in some of America's top markets, including Los Angeles, San Diego, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Tucson, Salt Lake City, and Denver. And I just think that it's great that you are both on the East Coast and the West Coast. I'd like to welcome Ambassador Aharoni, please, for our next section with opening remarks. Would you like to take my seat and sit in the middle?
No, actually, I'd like to stand.
Okay.
I'd like this microphone to work.
Oh, can you?
One. Okay, great. Thank you so much, Hannah, for including me in such an esteemed panel. I am honored, really, such an accomplished panel, and I'm so happy to be here in the presence of Rabbi Feldman. I've known since his days in Fifth Avenue Synagogue. And you kind of embarrassed me for long minutes with all reading my entire CV. You know, Israel had once a legendary foreign minister. His name was Abba Ibn, and he used to say jokingly every time his bio was read out publicly, he used to say, well, you know, I didn't do all the things you said I did, but I certainly did more than you think I did. And that was his icebreaker. I'm very happy to be here and to be providing some remarks and thoughts about the context of the things that we are all experiencing since October 7th. Just before I came in here, I met my old friend Ari Fruchter, who back in Spencer Tunick. It was 11? Okay, 2011. I'm getting too old. But about 13 years ago, we did some work together to try and improve not so much Israel's image as Israel's positioning. A lot of you are concerned with Israel's PR. If I had $1 for every time someone approached me and asked me, why can't Israel have better public relations, I would be a billionaire. But the truth is, as much as we could have used better PR, as much as we could have used sharper messaging, as much as we could have done things better, the problem that we have today is not one of public relations. Let me explain. In marketing, there's a basic term known as positioning. Positioning is what you do, whether you're the city of Jerusalem or whether you're the state of Israel, the things that you do on a policy level to improve your position vis-a-vis your competition. And your positioning must reflect your relative advantage. You cannot build a positioning on your weaknesses. If you will build your positioning on your weaknesses, you're guaranteed to fail. Now, humans are programmed to sympathize with the underdog. That's why when we see a little baby, we immediately drawn to them. And we usually smile and say, "Oh, what a beautiful baby." When we see a little puppy, same reaction. Just the other day, I came back from a month-long speaking tour, North America. I was sitting in a gate waiting for a flight in Fort Lauderdale. And there was a big screen TV in front of me. And there was a basketball game between two college teams. I knew nothing about any of the teams, but I saw one thing. One team was leading the other by 55 points. I immediately sympathized with the losing team without knowing them. All right? Why am I saying this? Because in any given geopolitical conflict, when you have such a dramatic disparity, people's biological conditioning is to identify with the underdog. Now, Zionism, from even before Theodor Herzl, from the days of the pre-sages of Zionism, the people that conceived the idea of Jewish independence decades before Theodor Herzl, Zionism was viewed clearly as the underdog. And we held that position throughout the pogroms in Eastern Europe, throughout the violence in then Palestine against Jews in 1921, 1929, 1936, certainly in 1948, we were outnumbered. Nobody was helping us in 1948 but world Jews, in particular American Jews. No government was officially supporting Israel in 1948. You should know that. And then certainly in 67, we were viewed as the underdog. In 73, we were viewed as the underdog. So until something happened in the early 1980s, we firmly held the positioning of the underdog. And it's not that we did not have public relations issues. We had. But the very positioning was in our favor. What happened in 1982? Israel basically translated its physical and economic might, its advantage over its opponent, in this case it was the PLO, into a military action, and the world saw a reversal of the positioning. So overnight, we went from being the regional David to becoming the regional Goliath. Now, the leaders of Israel at the time, they were not thinking of public relations. They were not thinking of image. They were thinking they had a geopolitical problem. They wanted to solve the problem. What they didn't know is there is this theory of that is called the theory of unintended consequence. You do one thing, but it has effect on other things. In this case, it impacted Israel's positioning in a very grave manner. Why? Because, and remember, even Ronald Reagan, who was a great friend of the state of Israel, he had on his desk in the Oval Office a picture of a three-year-old Lebanese boy that was killed in Israel's invasion into Lebanon. So even Reagan, who sympathized with Israel, he also sympathized with the suffering of the children of Lebanon. You have to understand the positioning of the underdog is powerful. And that is the main problem that we're facing today. Now, what's the solution? I spent many, many years studying Israel's positioning, not only in the States, but all over the world. And I came to realize, and I think that I mentioned it to some of our viewers when we did our webinar. I came to realize that there's a rule that applies to most Western countries, including France. 10, 20, 70. That's the rule. The 10 stand for the 10% that no matter what we do or say, profoundly dislike us. Who are they? Certainly, the intellectual elite, the people that buy into this whole colonialism narrative. Many of them are Jewish, by the way. Many of them are Muslims that live in the Western world. Many of them are children of Palestinian families. That's the 10%. Then you have, and by the way, before 10-7, I used to say to people, don't waste your time and money arguing with the Noam Chomskys of the world, because there's nothing you can do or say to change their mind. They're not buying whatever it is that we're trying to sell them. Then you have the 20%. The 20% are the people that report deep emotional connection to the state of Israel. When something happens in Israel, they feel as if it happened to them. It's the same way Israelis reacted to 9/11. Israelis felt that what happened in New York City is if it happened in Israel. Who are those 20%? Obviously, Jews who are Zionists, but not all Jews are Zionists. In fact, the majority of Jews in America are not Zionists. This is not the case in Canada. It's not the case in South Africa. It's not the case in Australia. It's not even the case in England. It's not the case in France. It's the case in the United States. There are historical reasons for it. The majority of Jews in America are not Zionists, which explains the silence after 10-7 for many of your friends. It explains many things, but there are historical reasons. This is not to say that today they're not more Zionistic than ever. Today they're more Zionistic than ever. But in 1948, only 17% of American Jews identified with the Zionist movement. When David Ben-Gurion reached out to 26 high-ranking Jewish military officers that participated in World War II, 26, and he asked them to come here and volunteer and help him build the IDF. How many do you think of the 26 showed up? One. And his name was Colonel David Mickey Marcus. And he died right where I live in a friendly fire incident in June of 1948. And they made a movie about him, which I urge you to see, called Cast a Giant Shadow, with Kirk Douglas playing Colonel David Mickey Marcus. But that's a side story. So who are the 20%? Of course, Jews who love Israel. But the vast majority of the 20% are Christians. Christians that love Israel. That's the majority of the 20%. Now, that's a huge number, I want you to know. No other country can report the same level of emotional connection. And then you have the 70%. Who are the 70%? People that are both uninterested in Israel, in the Middle East, in this whole bundle, and uninformed, which makes them what? Vulnerable and susceptible to toxic messages that can come from the 10%. Now, the theory was, back in the day when I was working with people like Ari to try and improve Israel's positioning, the theory was that our job is to give the 70% the tools, the immune system, to be able to cope with the messages of the 10%. So when someone says Israel is an apartheid state, that they will be in a position to say, don't give me that, I know Israel. Let me give an example how it works. There are New Yorkers here, Shana's from New York, so you probably know the name Michael Miller. Do you know Michael Miller? Michael Miller was the head of the JCRC of New York, which is the political arm of the Jewish Federation. Back in 2010, he shows up in my office and he says, Ido, we have a young political star in the sky of New York politics. He was elected to the City Council of New York at the age of 28. He said he's black, he's Latino, and he's gay. And what I want you to do is invite him to come to Israel officially. Because if I invite him, that's nice. But you represent the state of Israel. I want you to invite him. I said, okay, what do you need me to do? He said, host him for lunch in your apartment. I will be there. Invite him officially and then help me to execute the schedule for him. I said, great, let's do that. And I said to myself, you know, at 28 years old, what could he possibly know about Israel? Well, this kid shows up in my apartment. He read books before he came. He knew everything. He was so curious. He wanted to know about the history. He wanted to know about the politics. He was incredible. Make a long story short, he went to Israel. He spent here for several days, came back. A complete Zionist. And today, Richie Torres is the number one spokesperson in Congress. That's how the system works. That's how the system works. Of course, the credit goes to Michael Miller, who identified him. I was just the vehicle. But he identified him as the star that he is. And we need many more Richie Torreses like that. And that's where you can help Israel today. By broadening the conversation, by broadening the scope through which Israel is being perceived, so that people know that Israel is a real place, is not a place that is defined by its problems, but rather as a place that is defined by its attempts to fix those problems. That's how we want Israel to be known. And sure enough, we have a reputation in technology and beyond to support that claim. Last thing that I will say, because Shana asked me to speak a little bit about, you know, how I ended up doing what I'm doing. I retired from government about 8 years ago, and I've been in business and academics since then. But let me tell you, my gift was that I learned how to love my work. And that's really what I wanted to convey to you. I was given the opportunity, the privilege of representing the state of Israel. I was unique in the sense that I think I'm the only person in the history of the Foreign Service that his entire career was spent in the United States. I mean, nowhere else but the United States. I started in LA, and I held two positions in New York. And I was lucky to serve as the Consul General in New York, which in my book is the most important position that Israel could have anywhere in the world. Why? Because you are working with the most important people in every field, from finance to business to academics to media, you mentioned media, sports, whichever field you're looking at, New York is the epicenter of everything that is happening in the world. Imagine that of the financial transactions that take place every day all over the world, over 50% of the financial transactions globally go through New York City daily. That's how powerful New York is. And that's why Al-Qaeda attacked New York and also Washington, but mainly they wanted to attack New York because New York still is the nerve center of Western civilization. So for me, it was a privilege, and I used to wake up every morning with a great deal of energy to perform my job. And in some days, I didn't want the day to end because I liked my job so much. And so this is really my message to you. Find a way to fall in love with what you do, or do something that you know you already love. And that's the key, really, not only to be happy, but also to be very effective and to perform on a very high level of energy. One last thing that I wanted to say about the general context, because I heard the wonderful newscast that Shana read and shared with us. It's tough for all of us to try and look at what's happening from, you know, 30,000 feet above. But it's essential. And here's my message to you. I want you to think about what's happening in the context of something that is much bigger than Israel versus Hamas or even Israel versus the Palestinians. There are two things that are happening that are much bigger than that. The first is view 10-7 as part of a global effort to undermine the positioning of the United States in the world. All right, that is an axis led by Russia, by China. Iran is an active part of it. Unfortunately, South Africa is now betting on that axis rather than betting on the United States. But this is the context geopolitically. The second thing, and I'll end with that, 10-7 should be viewed not as part of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That's the mistake that most people make, certainly in American media. It has very little to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It has everything to do with this inter-civilizational clash that Americans felt after 9/11 and many Americans feel today. It's the West against what we call global jihad. Because essentially, there is no difference between the brutality that you saw on 10/7 and the brutality displayed by ISIS against Yazidi women. Or, when was the last time hundreds of women were abducted and raped and mutilated? Do you know? Nigeria, 10 years ago, Boko Haram. 300 girls were abducted. Only 120 of them were released. The rest of them, we don't know what happened to them until this very day. Very little information. A good friend of mine was a minister in the Nigerian government. Her name was Obi. She started a campaign, bring them back home, and she managed to bring back 120 of them. So my point is, it's a clash that we describe as inter-civilizational clash between cultures and nations and societies that center their belief around the concept of life and cultures that do exactly the opposite. What is Hamas if not a death cult? Read their charter to understand. There's not one word in their charter about the future. It's all about the past. There's not one word in their charter about a better future for the Palestinian people or for any people for that matter. So remember that. It's important to have some sort of non-belligerency with our friends, with our neighbors, with our colleagues. We don't want to be in a violent environment, whether we drive on Route 1 or whether we fight in Gaza, whether I was a soldier in Lebanon in 1982. Everybody wants to avoid violence. But remember, what do you do philosophically when you have to deal with an enemy that does not value life, that does not abide by the same rules that we all abide by? It's a big dilemma. And that is the message that we need to convey to the people that don't fully understand what we're dealing with. It has very little to do with the political circumstances between Israelis and Palestinians. It has a lot to do with the war that global jihad waged against our way of life. It's not what we do, it's what we stand for, and please remember that. And on this happy note, good night and enjoy the evening.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your opening remarks.